But we're in Mark chapter 15, and we're going to look at verses 16 through 21 today. When I first began preparing for this, my intention was, well, we've kind of already covered the bulk of that, and we'll just do that and keep on going and work through the cross today as well. But as I kept running into interesting things, things that needed to be said, I went, okay, never mind. We'll just cover those verses, and we'll get to the cross later on. So we're going to look at that passage. Last time, we had Pilate dealing with Jesus, and we ended up with the words there in... I'm on the wrong page. Let me turn back a page in my Bible so I'm reading the right words. We round up there in verse 15, where they had asked for Barabbas, and Pilate had Jesus scourged and handed him over to be crucified. And so you would say, okay, now we're going to watch the march to the cross and maybe some other events getting ready for that. But actually, Mark kind of takes a step backwards. Now, I don't know if Mark knew he took a step backwards or not, but he goes back and describes some things here in Mark 15 that we're going to study today that actually occurred a bit earlier. If you look at the other Gospels, it's pretty clear that's what happened, and we'll talk about maybe why Mark might have recorded it that way a little bit later. But that's where we were. So let's read Mark 15, 16 through 21.
And the soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is, the governor's headquarters, and they called together the whole battalion. And they clothed him in a purple cloak, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they were striking his head with a reed, and spitting on him, and knocking, and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his own clothes on him, and they led him out to crucify him.
21, one more.
Oh, and 21. And they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross.
All right. So, now one of the things that we need to remember was in the way Mark brings the account together, he kind of divides it in an interesting place because Pilate had already had Jesus scourged. Okay, we need to have that in our minds as we look at what happened in these verses. And without being unnecessarily graphic, and it's interesting, you don't find this in the scriptures, and there's a reason why, I believe, from what I've read. But what you don't find is a description of the actual scourging, the lashes hitting, and what happened, and the physical suffering that Jesus underwent during the scourging. It's just a simple statement. They scourged him. But we know from history that this scourging, I'm not going to describe all how it was done, but when you get to the bottom line is, he was probably injured to the level that you could see bone sticking out, okay? Can we go that far? This is severe injury. And it's done to exacerbate the pain as well as to physically harm the individual, challenging their life continuing. It was not uncommon for people to die during this process. So here's Jesus. He's already been scourged when we get to these verses. And we're going to go through these verses and then we're going to take a look by using the Gospel of John, as well as some other scriptures along the way. But we're going to go back and go, so how does this really fit in and see how it fits together? So in verse 16, we see that the soldiers took him away into the palace. Or the praetorium, is the praetorium, is the way the New American Standard says it. And that's a little bit unexpected in a way. Because the soldiers operated out of a fort right next to the temple grounds, which was not far from the praetorium. So why didn't they go to their military area to do this punishment, to get him ready to go to the cross? And we may see a little bit of a hint when we get over to John as to why they did this, but that praetorium is a palace. The fort's called Fort Antonia, but this praetorium was built by Herod. It was started in AD 23. It was massive. I mean, when you, yes, sir.
We're talking about Romans, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, these are Roman soldiers. Yes, that did this. But that this palace is massive. When you think of the grandest form of the word palace, this is it and maybe then some. They said that there were bed chambers for approximately 100 guests. 100-room hotel is pretty big. And this was built to honor Rome and whoever was governing at the time. And it was used by the Roman governors. The most elite troops by title were called the Praetorian Guard. So Praetorian really isn't a title for the palace. It's really titled after these elite soldiers. But it's their palace. I mean, it's the Roman governor's palace, but that's where you find the Praetorian Guard. But obviously we have more than that, because when we look at verse 16, when they took him into the palace, they called together the whole Roman cohort. Yours said a different word, Barry. What did yours say?
Battalion.
Yeah, it's a piece of a big army. The Roman cohort was approximately 1/10 of... Now I lost that word. I think I wrote it down here. I don't see it. I didn't write it down, but they're big chunks of armies, could have about 6,000 in them. Might have 4,000, depends on age, but about this time, about 6,000, and this, it took 10 cohorts to make one army. I'm sorry, I can't remember the right name of the right term that they used for it. But so we probably have about 600 soldiers, maybe 400. Depends on how you think the history came together and how Rome was counting their armies at the time. But we've got a complete Roman cohort. And what's their function? What's their role with Jesus right now? It's really quite simple: to guard him so that he doesn't get away. This man's just been scourged. I mean, they're just to hold him. They're a holding group. Does it take this many men? No, they didn't call the cohort over because they needed that many men. And we're going to see by their actions why they did this, because we see there in verse 17, this turns into a great party, fun time, whatever you want to call it for these folks. They're feeling raised up because they're able to mock this Jew. In verse 17, they dressed him up in purple and twisted a crown of thorns and put it on him. And so first they stripped him. That would have been a moment of humiliation for Jesus. Then they dressed him in purple. It's interesting. In Matthew, it says scarlet. So what's the deal? Well, it's all speculation. One of maybe many ways to explain it is, one of the pieces that was a part of every one of the Roman soldiers' uniform was a scarlet cape kind of thing. They called it a mantle. And they would wear it every day. And this reddish scarlet color would fade over time and kind of become purplish. Don't know if that was it or not. If that's what they used, that material was not what you would think of as finery kinds of something to wear. It was a rough battle intended piece of material. And so if that's what they put on Jesus, it could have been a very, very rough material. But anyway, they dressed him up and they put on this crown of thorns. Some of the descriptions by people that study these things said that the thorns on this crown could have been 12 inches long. There was a plant, that thorny bush that grew, that was could have very typically been used. We don't know what they used. But it says that they put it on, and they put it on him. And then verse 18, then they start really mocking him. They began to acclaim him or mock him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And then they were, in verse 19, kept beating his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling and bowing before him. This King of the Jews, "Hail, King of the Jews," if you look at it, What? How did they greet Caesar when they saw him? It was "Hail Caesar!" So now they've got kind of a mocking, like in some of the German or the World War II era movies I've seen, where you see the Americans or other soldiers mocking Hitler, you know, with their fake Heil Hitlers and all that. That's what they're doing here. They're making fun of him to the max. Which, by the way, this was not uncommon. It would be how they treated, typically, the Romans treated people. I want to say it in a non-condescending way, but people are mentally deficient. What's the right word? I don't know how to be politically correct and kind all at the same time there and say it, but they would take people who had mental deficiencies and just treat them terrible. They'd mock them, make fun of them. And so that's how they're treating Jesus. They're acting like he's a deranged person. And in a sense, you can understand their mindset. This guy's claiming to be king of the Jews. The Jews don't want him. You know, you've had all these things go on. And so they're mocking him to the max. And so they also began to beat his head with a reed. The best Greek translation, that would be stick. The plant that would be typically talked about here is called calamos. They had a plant near Jordan, and it was very similar to, not exactly the same, but very similar to bamboo. And I don't know if you've ever heard of caning. It was in the news some years ago. They caned some people in Singapore for some reason. I don't remember what the offense was, but it can be a very severe beating. A bamboo stick is not something you really want to get hit with. So in its similarity, this is not some just kind of wimpy thing they're doing. They're being hard on him. Yes, sir.
I'm just going to say the Roman soldiers have been battling these people for the last 300 years.
Well, that's something that needs to be put in here, and I've got that down to say, you know, that the Romans hated the Jews. I mean, make no bones about it. A lot of the areas that Rome would conquer benefited a lot from it. And honestly, Palestine probably benefited a lot. They became part of the world economy. You got trade going on. The nation probably prospered under the Romans, but the Jews were just not willing to give up their autonomy, and so they just didn't. They despised the Romans. The zealots, as they were called, went around. Their primary function as a zealot: if you get a Roman soldier off by themselves, you kill them by stabbing. I mean, that's just what they do. Roman soldiers had to be careful about being by themselves. Some Jew would sneak up behind them and put a knife in them, and so. And the feelings were likewise. I mean, it was very contentious and hateful. So here they've got one of these despised Jews in their midst, and they're making the most of it. And so, remember, when he's getting beat on the head, what's he got on? He's got that crown. So the crown on the head, there could be a lot of blood going on here. I don't know if you realize it, but your head's a very blood-engorged organ. The brain and all that, but we probably weren't piercing the skull, but your body is well equipped to send a lot of blood to your head area. So I don't know if you've ever had a nosebleed, but that gives you an idea how easily blood can get going there. And so they're doing that, and they kept beating him and spitting on him, taking turns. Can you imagine that? This is not an easy thing to describe, and we don't even get the worst of it in the scriptures, because they don't really go into the physical suffering as much as they could. And kneeling and bowing before him. So they're making the most of this. This is a lot of fun. And it's interesting when you think about, well, they called their whole Roman cohort together. Is this the same Roman cohort that went out to arrest Jesus? It may have been. We don't know. Maybe some of the people... You know, who knows how those soldiers got mixed up back and forth. I would think they would all keep together. But if they were, you know, this isn't that different than the trial of Caiaphas, is it? You know, they were hitting him and slapping him around and spitting on Jesus. So that's what was going on. By the way, let's go over and look at chapter 10 in Mark and read verses 32 through 34.
And they were on the way going up to Jerusalem, and Jerusalem before them. And Jesus went before them. And they were troubled, and as they followed, they were afraid. And Jesus took the 12 again and began to tell them what things should come unto him, saying, Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be delivered unto the high priests and to the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles. And they shall mock him, and scourge him, and spit upon him, and kill him. But the third day he shall rise again.
So, what is unexpected here from Jesus' perspective? Not a thing. He has told them this is what's going to happen. This was a prophetic utterance by Christ, saying, look, this is what's going to happen. And of course, if we went back and read more in Mark, what comes in Mark right after that is, hey, I want to be great in your kingdom. They didn't get it, did they? But that's another story. So Jesus predicted it. Go read Isaiah 50, verse 6. And it's interesting, Isaiah 50, verse 6 is kind of just stuck in there and doesn't seem to fit. But being we're on the side of Christ that we are, we can see what Isaiah 50, verse 6 is referring to. Who's got that for us? Isaiah 50, verse 6.
I give my back to those who strike, and my cheeks to those who pull out the beard. I hide not my face from disgrace and spitting.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a prophecy about what this Savior would come and endure. So prophesied in the Old Testament, prophesied by Christ himself, and there are many other places we could go and see prophecies about how Jesus was going to be treated. But verse 20, back to Mark 15, verse 20. So in verse 20, after they had mocked him, so they've had their fun, they took the purple robe off of him and put on his own garments, and they led him out to crucify him. So now we're on the path. We're headed to the hill where he's going to be hoisted up on the cross and put to death. Verse 21, they pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon the Cyrene, which is the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. We're going to take verse 21 and we're going to bring it in later. We'll just kind of clean the rest of this whole episode up a little bit and see how it fits in. To do that, I want to go over to John chapter 19. And we're going to work our way through the first 16 verses. So first, let's just read it, if I can get a volunteer to do that. And if you don't want to read it all, you can stop. Somebody else can pick it up. But verse 19, 1 through 16. John 19, 1 through 16.
Okay.
Thanks, Barry.
Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They came up to him saying, Hail, King of the Jews, and struck him with their hands. Pilate went out again and said to them, See, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him. So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to him, Behold the man. When the chief priests and officers saw him, they cried out, Crucify him! Crucify him! Pilate said to them, Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him. The Jews answered him, We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God. When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, Where are you from? But Jesus gave him no answer. So Pilate said to him, You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you? Jesus answered him, You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin. From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a house called, at a place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. Now it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, "Behold your king." They cried out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So he delivered him over to them to be crucified. So
all right.
He took Jesus.
Yep. Yeah, no, we're going to stop at 16. So maybe you're 16 anyway. Doesn't matter. Thank you, Barry. Well done. So it starts out there in verse 1. Pilate then took Jesus and scourged him. Well, that in Mark is at the end of last week's lesson and before what we started reading today. But John kind of puts it all together. So he was scourged him, and then the soldiers twisted together the crown, and we'll talk about all that. But let's first ask this question. Why would Mark and John tell this story maybe with a little bit different set of order or details? So let's talk about that. Where was John during all these things that were going on? Remember, we talked about that a couple weeks ago, maybe three. Huh?
Wasn't he inside the, what do they call it?
He was inside the courtyard. We see he and Peter go together to the courtyard, or wind up at both in the courtyard. They were both there, and this is at the trials of Jesus before the Jews. Just let's skip ahead a little bit. Where is John when Jesus is on the cross?
At his feet.
He's at his feet, because Jesus transfers responsibility of his mother to John. Now, all of this happened. The cross is 3 o'clock in the afternoon is when Jesus is dead. It's done. And we start in the middle of the night. So in all probability, John is pretty much there most of the time, it looks like. Now, maybe he went away and got the Marys that were at the foot of the cross or some of that. I don't know. I'm not trying to paint that picture. But let's contrast that with where Peter is. Why is Peter important to the story of Mark? Go back to our introduction to Mark a long time ago. Mark wrote from what perspective? Who's he writing to? That'll be important before we're done. What's that? Well, he's writing to the Romans.
Yeah, okay.
So Mark has put this down for the Romans. Who was Mark pretty much following around with?
Peter.
So he's going to get, we get Peter's perspective that was, according to tradition, okay, tradition, can you certainly plan on it? No, but in this case, it's probably got at least a kernel of truth to it. According to tradition, Mark follows Peter around, kind of is at his right hand. He's at Paul's right hand part of the time. But when Peter was in the ministering to the Roman people, that's Mark was there with him, his tradition. And Peter had an oral history about all of this that the Romans and maybe Peter said, put this down. So Mark is putting down what he's heard Peter say many times, is the general belief about the Gospel of Mark and the perspective it's written from. What's going on with Peter during this time? Remember what happened to him? He's over there in the courtyard, and people start accusing him of being one of them, and he denies Christ three times, right? And what does Peter do as a result? He goes out, runs off, and weeps bitterly. What do you think is the problem? By the way, of all the people involved in the story, once Peter does this denial, what other person would be most common in their experience at that moment to Peter?
Judas.
Judas.
Yeah.
You know, Peter has betrayed the Christ. There's only one other apostle that's done that. His name's Judas. Now, the rest have scattered, but they haven't openly betrayed Christ like Peter did. And Peter's off weeping bitterly. So is Peter probably involved in the details or thinking about the even if Peter was there, what's he thinking about? What would you be thinking about? What have I done? I can't undo this. What have I done? I mean, it'd be hard to ever get past that, wouldn't it? And so we're getting, probably indirectly through Mark, Peter's account. And so it's got some abbreviations and some focus points that are probably that are a little different than John's, who was probably right there, or at least more likely than Peter would have been right there watching it, taking it in. And so let's look at what we have, how we see John describe this. And we see pretty much the same thing in verse in most of these verses, but kind of a little different order and a few other things added in. So in verse 1, we see scourged by Pilate. In verse 2, we see the same thing that verse 2 and 3 really is our whole passage that we're looking at over in Mark. Soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns, put it on his head, put a purple robe on him, began to come up to him and say, "Hail, King of the Jews," to slap him in the face. But in verse 4, we get a little bit different take on this. Pilate came out again and said to them, and who's he talking to when he came out? Who's this them? Huh? To the Jews. "Behold, I'm bringing him out to you so that you may know that I find no guilt in him." Okay, he hasn't brought Jesus out yet, but he announces, "I'm going to bring him out so you can know I don't find any guilt in him." What has he just done with Jesus? He has scourged him. He's let the soldiers mock him, put the crown of thorns on him, his head, and he's going to bring a man out to them. And we can only guess, but he probably was going, "I want you to have empathy, sympathy, compassion, something for Jesus, knowing I don't have any, find any guilt in him, and look at how badly he's already been punished," which to me is just cowardice. If you don't think he had anything wrong with him, why didn't you, when the Jews came, go, "I know your game, you go home, Jesus, you're free." And that, if he really had no guilt in him, that's what he should have done, right? But anyway, but Jesus came out, and in this case, he's still got the crown of thorns on his head and the purple robe. And Pilate gives that saying that we've heard so many times, "Behold the man." What does that mean? Look. This is an emphatic look. See what, see what's, who, what's happened here. Look at him. Now, Pilate was not a good judge of people. We know that for lots of reasons, right? We can just see his insights into how people think and act and do. He's manipulated by these guys just right and left. He never gets his will out to them or is even influential at all with them. So when the chief priests and officers saw him, officers of the Jews, instead of saying, "Oh man, you're right, this innocent man just been beaten to death, we better let him go." No, they've got bloodlust. "Crucify him." So now Pilate says something he's already said once before. You take care of him. I don't want to deal with him. He says, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." So Pilate says, "No, I'm gonna give you, only Rome has authority to take a life." Before, they would have taken him out and stoned him. But now he's being very specific. "I'm going to give you, as a Jewish people, the prerogative to do what Rome is only authorized to do. You can do it for us. You go crucify him, because I don't think he deserves crucifixion." And so on they go, and so the Jews have an answer for that. The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and by that law he ought to die, because he made himself out to be the Son of God." If you go back and carefully pull everything out of the scriptures, I read this, I didn't do it myself. There are 7 indictments made against Jesus. 1, that he would destroy the temple, meaning they said it was Solomon's temple. We know he was talking about himself. That he is an evildoer, very general. That he's perverting the nation. that he forbids payment of tax to Caesar, that he's stirring up the people, meaning inciting riots, and that he claimed to be king. That's the six. All of those are false, right? The seventh one is the one we see here. He claimed to be the Son of God. That's the only one that is a true, legitimate accusation, and it's only an accusation if it's a false statement. But this one Jesus would agree to as a true statement, and he didn't say he was the very Son of God. So something interesting happens then when they bring this accusation against Jesus here. Therefore, in verse 8, when Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. And the fear changes. He's afraid of a riot. He's afraid of what the Jews are going to do. He's afraid of a lot of things. Now the fear is directed toward Christ. Why would this cause more fear for him?
He just beat him.
You're going to kill.
Well, first of all, if he really is the Son of God, I really wasn't very kind to him, was I? Okay, but there's more to it than that, probably. Because if he was a typical Roman, they believed in a whole lot of gods. And there are lots of stories in the Roman world of gods coming down and interacting with men, and when you don't do it right, bad things happen. Don't know what made him afraid, but it had to do with Jesus. So he goes back into the praetorium, and you can tell he's concerned about, well, what? Who is this? Is he a god? And you can tell it in his question. Because he said to Jesus, where are you from? So he goes in almost a little bit like, where are you from? What have I got myself into? But Jesus gave him no answer. And Pilate, switches again. And Pilate said to him, you don't speak to me? I mean, he's offended by Jesus. Do you not know I have authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you? It's kind of like he was afraid of him for a minute, but now he's back asserting his position and power over Christ. And Jesus said, you would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin. Now, when Jesus says you wouldn't have any power unless it came from above, what does that mean?
Romans 13. All power comes from God.
That's what Jesus means. That's not the only way necessarily Pilate could have taken it. You've all been in the workplace, particularly if it's a bigger workplace. Oh, this comes from above. What does that mean? Somebody more important than the people in the room have dictated this, and so we really can't discuss it and change it. We're just going to have to do it. Pilate could have taken that. Well, you don't get your power. If it weren't for Caesar, you wouldn't have any power. Or he could have taken it. The gods have already given you power. Now, Jesus' statement, your power comes from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has greater sin than you have. Does this mean Pilate was okay? No. Where's Pilate headed? Let's just rephrase that. Where is Pilate already living in one sense? He's already in hell, just like we're already in heaven, right? We're living in the kingdom now. There's a lot more fulfillment that we're looking forward to. But we're part of the kingdom. We live in the kingdom. It's just the earthly side. Well, he's on the earthly side of hell. He's living in a mess. This is not pleasant. But when Jesus says the other one has a greater sin, that implies something, doesn't it? Is hell the same for everybody? Now, it's clear in the scriptures. There is a greater condemnation for, and then there will be something after it. So, Jesus is making it clear who's going to be held mostly accountable or accountable in a greater way. So, they work through all that. And Pilate is not off the hook. There are varying penalties in hell. And so Pilate, again in verse 12, tries again to get him released. We don't know exactly what he did, but it didn't go anywhere because the Jews cried out, if you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar. So what are they saying here?
Saying they don't understand the spirit.
You don't do what we want, we're going to call your boss.
I'm going to tell on you. We've all had another kid, a brother, a sister, or somebody that would say that, right? And we know exactly what they mean by it. And that's exactly what they said. Who are you going to line yourself up with here, Jesus or Caesar? And implied in the background is Caesar is who he needs to line up with, or they're going to be telling Caesar. And they may even mean that a little bit more in a later verse to come. But when Pilate heard these words, he's like, okay, I can't get anywhere with this. I don't have any choice. Was he really a governor? No, he was just a servant. He just didn't know who he was serving. So he brought Jesus out, and then Pilate did something for the first time that's recorded here that was an official act for a Roman governor. He sat down on the judgment seat in a place called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Okay? And we don't really archaeologically know exactly where this is, but there's enough references to it. It's kind of in an area closest to the fort, but kind of out there near the Praetorium Temple, or near the palace, and it's an official judgment seat, the Bema seat. There's a Bema seat, revelationary judgment, but this is what they called it right here, was the Bema seat. This is, okay, I'm going to judge now. I'm going to say something. I'm going to make a proclamation. And it was the day of the preparation for the Passover, about the sixth hour. This is 9 o'clock in the morning. And we could go through how Jews counted time and how Romans counted time and why in one gospel it says sixth hour and another one says ninth. We could do all that. I'm just going to cut to the chase and say this is as close as they kept time. 9 o'clock in the morning. And he said to the Jews, once again, look, your king. So they cried out, away with him, away with him, take him away, whatever, crucify him. Pilate says again, shall I crucify your king? The chief priests answered, I would not want to be because of fear, but I've got just enough curiosity. I think it would be fun if somebody had a GoPro. I'll put it that way. I wouldn't want to be a fly on the wall. But a GoPro in heaven at this moment would have been interesting, wouldn't it? Can you imagine God's reaction to this? We have no king but Caesar.
What?
Well, and God's not going to get him for lying right here, is he?
For Samuel 8, that's what they said.
Because that's the truth. They have aligned themselves with Caesar because that's what they're willing to do to see Jesus go to the cross. So he, Pilate, then handed him over to them. This is the Roman cohort now. Back to the Roman soldiers to be crucified. And so let's go back over to Mark. Questions, comments so far? We've done an awful lot of the stuff. There's some real interesting things that we're going to talk about in these last few minutes on their walk to the cross,
The concept of the grace of God. First the creation rejected God, then the Jews. He picked the Jews out, they rejected God. Then the apostles slept through on the mountain, and then Peter rejected. So it's just pretty much uniform.
You know, just for clarity, let's answer this question, but then also make kind of an interesting counterpoint. There were a lot of promises given to Abraham and to the Jews. You've got the covenant with Abraham. You've got the covenant with Moses. You've got the covenant with David. There's a lot of covenants made to the Jews as a people and as a nation, right? Are those promises still valid, or have they been shifted to the church? I just cut right to the thing people argue about.
Deuteronomy 28 says, if you do this, this will happen. If you don't do this, this will happen.
Yeah, and you could also go over to Romans chapter 10.
Or 9.
Well, part of 9. I mean, 9 introduces it, but Paul then says in 10, Are these promises then null and void? God forbid, may it never be. Not all Israel is Israel. And when we look at at what we see in the book of Revelation and what's coming, and you see the prophecies of Daniel, the nation of Israel and the Jews, at least as a subset group, definitely still receive the promises of God.
Because they are believers and called out by God.
They are the ones that God preserves for himself.
Just like any other group, though.
Just like any other group. But it's interesting here. Right here, they've said, we have no king but Caesar. And by AD 70, they won't be a nation anymore, will they? It's just interesting what God... I'm not saying there's a direct correlation, but they have abandoned their role as God's people, as a nation, by rejecting his son. And you got the parable of the vineyard and whatever. So it's kind of interesting. This statement, I think, shows a turning point in who the Jews are. Because prior to this point, would the scribes and Pharisees and the Sanhedrin, would they have all been saying, yeah, hail Caesar? No, you're a zealot? You're killing Jews? Here's a little more money. Buy some more knives. I mean, that's who they were. They wanted those Romans out of there so bad they could scream and probably cry themselves to sleep many nights over it because of these foreign people in here. But anyway, let's move on back to Mark. I just find that interesting. That's really not the point of our message today. So in Mark chapter 15, we kind of held verse 21 back. In verse 21, they're marching from where Jesus was held and mocked and all the things that were done off to the cross to be crucified. And they pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. Now, you probably are as aware as anybody of the way that the Romans typically did this. What did they do with the cross to get the cross to the site of execution?
Condemned had to drag it.
The condemned had to take his own cross. And why was that?
It's heavy.
Well, it was heavy. We're not going to carry your cross. It also wore them down. Because people could stay alive on the cross for days sometimes. All right. Now, what did they carry?
Cross.
This could be a fun argument. Because generally, most people today would say that he carried just a cross beam. That the post probably was even already in the ground when they hoisted it. But the tradition for a long, long time prior to modern archaeology was that it would have been the entire cross, both pieces. And to make it further complicated to say for sure, our archaeology shows it was done both ways. So we don't really know whether it was the cross beam, although that's probably more likely because of the time that this happened, or whether it was the vertical piece as well and it was already hooked together, okay? So we don't know, but probably the beam. So why would they have why would they employ him to help?
Jesus would be so bad he couldn't really carry it.
Jesus probably couldn't hardly carry it, but what did the Roman soldiers care if Jesus died on the way?
Been better.
Been easier for them, maybe. What would be the problem with that?
Mess up prophecy.
Yeah.
He's going to be lifted up on a cross. What do they care if it takes him 24 hours to do it? Maybe he only does a step every 40 minutes. Why is that a problem?
Passover,
as a matter of fact. It is very clear that Jesus is going to breathe his last and give it up. It's finished at 3:00 in the afternoon. The very time that they were killing the Passover lambs in the temple. So God has an order here. We've got to get him. It's 9:00 when they are doing a lot of this court stuff. Don't know how much longer it took for them to start the march. We've got from 9:00 to 3:00. We've only got 6 hours to have this thing done. And so God provides. We need to get this over there. We need to get it done. Now, is that the exact reason? I don't know, but certainly Simon did this. Why would we make such a big deal about Simon and who he is? Well, first of all, it adds credibility to the story, right? And he mentions this Alexander and Rufus. I guess probably then some of the people must have known these guys. They go, yeah, this is a real guy. I've heard of him. He's the father of these two. We've got four passages we're going to look at. I say passages. They're all single verses. Well, not quite. Acts 2 is the one that has a little more. Go over to Acts 2, verses 5 through 11. What we're going to talk about for a moment is this Cyrenian connection. By the way, anybody know where Cyrene is? What's that? Right. What, you know what country it's in?
Libya.
Libya. Do you know what city Cyrene is today? Nope. Good guess, but no.
Tripoli.
We could have said, and today we'd say, this is Simon from Tripoli. Interesting, I thought. Anyway. Acts 2, 5 through 11.
And there were dwelling at Jerusalem Jews, men that feared God of every nation. Now, when this was noised, the multitude came together and were astonished, because that every man heard them speak his own language. And they wondered all and marveled, saying among themselves, behold, are not all these which speak of Galilee? How then hear we every man in our own language, wherein we were born? Parthians, the Medes, the Elamites, and the inhabitants of Mesopotamia and of Judea, and of Cappadocia, Pontus, and Asia, and of Phrygia, and and of the parts of Libya, which is beside Cyrene, and strangers of Rome, and Jews, and proselytes, Cretes and Arabians, we heard them speak in our own tongues, and wonderful works of God, the wonderful works of God.
So, Pentecost, right? And they hear this noise and the rushing wind sound and all this, and people are praising God. And so here these people are, and they're going, what is this? Everybody's hearing it in their own language. You know, you got up to 50 people speaking, but they're all probably trying to speak in the same language, but yet everybody's hearing it in their own. So there's this miracle going on. And they list the people from where they all were. The point of it is there was a pretty good-sized Jewish contingent in what's now modern-day Tripoli. And that's the point of that. A lot of reading to get there. Go over to Acts 11:20. Just a single verse. Somebody can read that for us.
But there were some of them, men of Cyprus and Cyrene, who on coming to Antioch spoke to the Hellenists also, preaching the Lord Jesus.
So what we see here is we have, in effect, Christians from Cyrene coming up to Antioch, also involved in the ministry of Christ. So very early on, we have a group of people from Cyrene who are believers, and some of them are out in abroad spreading that belief. That was Acts 11:20, right?
Yeah.
Acts 13:1.
Now there were in the church at Antioch prophets and teachers, Barnabas, Simeon, who was called Niger, Lucius of Cyrene, Manian, a member of the court of Herod the Tetrarch, and Saul.
So we've got some international contingents there in Antioch, and one of them is a notable Cyrene. Now let's try Romans 16:13. Some of you probably have already seen this one coming. Romans 16:13. Let's talk about Romans before we read a minute. Romans is written by who?
Paul.
And it's written to who?
The Romans.
Romans. Has Paul been there yet? No. But yet we're going to see he knows some of the people in Rome. And he hasn't been there on a missionary journey. He's been there in captivity, right? So he's writing to the people in Rome. I'm not sure about that. This is before or after he was in captivity. This would have been before he was in captivity, wouldn't it? But anyway, he's writing to people in Rome. He's finishing up the book. Note part of who he addresses in his closing thoughts. Romans 16:13.
Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, also his mother, who has been a mother to me as well.
Most everybody believes this is the Rufus. I mean, Mark was written to the Romans, right? Mark wrote the gospel to record Peter's remembrance of what happened, and he wrote it for the Romans. That's what all of our tradition tells us. And he says, oh, by the way, Simon the Cyrene was the father of Alexander, not clearly stated. But here's Paul addressing the end of his book to a Christian in Rome called Rufus. So clearly Mark is thinking these people know Alexander and Rufus. So apparently this Cyrenian who carried the cross was the father of two Christian believers over in Rome that Mark mentions in the book so they could make the connection. You know these guys whose heritage is Cyrenian? It was their dad that carried the cross for Jesus, and probably almost certainly the same person that Paul noted in his closing remarks in the book of Romans. Yes, sir.
It's during this time, too, the first 100 years after Christ, that the Romans were basically exterminating all the Jews in northern Africa because of the rebellion.
Oh, there were, somewhere during this time, roughly this time, you've got the Jewish rebellion, you've got everything happening where AD 70 occurs. Now, this is almost certainly, Mark is written before AD 70, I think. But when you put all this together, when the Jews managed to get Jesus crucified and said, oh, hail King Caesar, he's our only king, they really didn't mean it. In the sense of politically, they got more difficult, things became more strained, they got more rambunctious. I think there was a big letdown when Jesus was crucified because here's Jesus, we're going to make him king, and he says, you know, Palm Sunday? And basically Jesus says, you don't understand. Yes, I'm going to be your king, but not in the way you think. I'm not going to throw the Romans out. I'm not going to do what you want. We know that's what they wanted because even after the resurrection, the apostles are still saying, are you now going to do it? Are you going to restore Israel and throw, and they didn't say it this way, but they meant it, and throw the Romans out? And Jesus said, no. Go to Pentecost. Go up and wait. And when the right day comes, the Holy Spirit will come upon you, and then you can see what my ministry is going to be. That's what they were looking for. And Jesus, they had all these hopes in Jesus. I mean, he had thousands and thousands of people following him out. He was feeding them all the miracles. I mean, he was making a big splash. They wanted their Messiah. They were looking forward to this political solution. And I think they tried to make it happen when it didn't happen with Jesus. And it just got really ugly with the Romans.
Well, it's crazy because if governments like the Caesars would look and they could ask themselves the questions, who would you rather have your subject be? These Christians who believed in this God, who said, do good, take care of people, and obey your government, or these Jews who don't.
Yeah, it was, when people want power, they want it on their terms. They don't sit around and say, well, who can we work with? They just say, everybody's going to work with me or else. And so they didn't get along with Christians very well either for a number of years. And then when they did have some level of agreement under Constantine, you begin to see the church become watered down. And things just went ugly from there. And yet, just like with the Jews, there's a remnant. So any other questions or comments? Well, I found these facts interesting, and I hope you did too. And next week, we'll pick it up with Mark, and we'll see Jesus arrive at Golgotha. So let's close with prayer. Father, you are the God of tremendous detail. We can see that in creation. We can see that when in our feeble ways we start to look at things on a very, very, very tiny level and see what goes on inside atoms and cells. And we know that in your care and concern, you take care of all the details, including getting Jesus to the cross. We thank you of this love story for us, a story of extreme sacrifice. But we also reminded that the word says that he endured the cross for the joy that was set before him. Lord, may we too take up our crosses and follow you with care, with very much intentional responses, giving up our lives as needed so that we too might enjoy the joy that is set before us. Let that be our motivation. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.